Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Ask not.
The Beatles.
Those circuses on the air.
When the president does it,
sometimes you feel like
that means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you don't.
Tear down this wall.
Here's Jennings.
Hey, Luke, may the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Oh, we're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
China's been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in six seasons, it's one goal achieved. The Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time. And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
Well, let's talk a little history because I've got a bunch this week. 1626, St. Peter's Basilica is consecrated, replaced an earlier basilica. It's the largest Christian basilica, of course, in the world. And
have
beautiful.
You ever been there?
I've never been there.
It's overwhelming.
I bet.
It's overwhelming.
I bet it is. When was the last time you visited?
It was 10 years ago, this year.
Wow.
We were there. And one of the places in Istanbul, Turkey, which is called the Hagia Sophia, was one of the first centers of early Christianity. And then it became a mosque.
Really?
Yeah, but wow. It was built, I want to say, around 500 or 600 A.D., you know, 1,000 years before
wow.
St. Peter's was consecrated. It is one of the most amazing places you will see. And when it was built, it was the largest enclosed space in the world.
Look at that.
In the world.
Wow. And now it's Woodfield. Gone from that to
the Mall of America.
Yeah, Mall of America. Yeah, it would be Mall of America. You're right.
No, seriously, both places, St. Peter's, the whole Vatican City, and it is a city,
yeah,
is just really, really amazing to see.
Very cool. Very cool. 1800, Congress held its first session in Washington, D.C. in an incompleted Capitol building. And now they just walk away from the completed Capitol building. With
yeah.
incompleted business, Dave. That's what happens there. Well, yeah, we'll see what
happens.
They've
been working on the dome. Haven't you seen
the yeah.
pictures all the time and again
yeah.
when you see pictures
the
of
structure
the,
around
the Capitol
there.
Dome?
Yeah.
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 Doing some renovation work.
I like that, though. They're
oh,
keeping
sure.
it up and keeping it clean and all that
mm-hmm.
good stuff. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
1894, the first newspaper, Sunday Color Comic Section, was published in the U.S., and it featured the Yellow Kid, the Cats and Jammer Kids, and the Happy Hooligan, which was your nickname in high school, wasn't it?
Happy Hooligan?
Yeah.
Something like that. Or a name that we cannot utter on the air.
That's right. That's
what
right.
What was the year again for that?
1894.
1894.
And I think our own Chicago Tribune had the Yellow Kid in the
did
paper.
Did they?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they carried the Cats and Jammer Kids
yeah.
as well.
That I knew. That I looked up because that's easy to find, some of those cartoons,
because oh, yeah.
they lasted a long time. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
1916, Samuel Goldwyn and Edgar Silwyn established Goldwyn Pictures. The company later became one of the most successful independent filmmakers. That was 1916. 1921, President Harding signs the Willis Campbell Act, forbidding doctors prescribing beer or liquor for medicinal purposes. What a bunch of crap.
Well, that was all in the whole Prohibition era, you know, moving into that era.
So I guess.
That had to go. That was going along with that.
But we're prescribing marijuana. Why can't you prescribe a little bourbon for a cold? That works. That's what my grandmother always told me. She'd warm a little
people
bourbon.
People got around it,
a hot
Dave.
Toddy.
People
yeah, they
got
did.
Around it. And so
they
did Warren Harding.
They did. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. 1926, the Chicago Blackhawks played their first game. And they beat Toronto 4-1. So it was the first game in 1926. Look at that.
This week.
All right, 1928, the first issue of Time magazine. Who was on the cover?
The first issue
1928.
Of Time. Oh, Gosh, I know this.
Betty White. No. Japanese Emperor Hirohito. Yeah, he was the first guy on the Time magazine.
On the first cover of Time.
Yeah, yeah. And then 1936 was the first edition of Life
now
magazine.
That I know. Yeah, it was one of the dams. Grand
yes,
Cooley
it was.
Dam.
God, you are the man. Fort Peck Dam over the Missouri River in Montana.
Ah, Fort Peck Dam, not
look
Grand Coulee Dam.
Okay. Yeah, look at you, man.
Okay.
19.
That was a neat picture.
Yeah.
If you look at that, you know, the black and white photography of the times and the design of the dam, it fit right in.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. You know what? I remember there was a magazine store in Skokie. I think he moved out of there, but it was a place where you could find every year of every magazine. And when my father
really?
Always had a milestone birthday, I would go by Life and Time mm-hmm. and whatever else I could find, newspapers. And it really told, you know, about the time
yeah,
of,
my,
you know, what was happening.
My cousin gave me a Life magazine from the week I was born.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
See some of that
to
stuff.
Think about what
yeah.
was going on.
1947, Meet the Press, one of the oldest running television programs, made its network debut on NBC. 1947.
Yeah, in the early days.
Yeah,
it's been on ever since.
It's
never missed a week.
Ever since, yep.
Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air. Ready for this afternoon's unrehearsed spontaneous press conference are four of America's top reporters. Here is the moderator of Meet the Press, Miss Martha Roundtree.
Good evening and welcome to Meet the Press.
Now, who has the first question? Mr. Loftus.
Mr. Quill.
Sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you, Senator Bowling, for your willingness to meet the press. Right now.
This is Ned Brooks inviting you to Meet the Press. And welcome once again to Meet the Press.
On our panel of questioners today are Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Here is our moderator, Lawrence Spivak.
Resuming our interview, our guest today on this one-hour special edition of Meet the Press.
Are you a citizen of this country?
In terms of actual rights, I mean, are you?
Obviously not.
I have the feeling, based in part on my own experience in Hanoi.
After 28 years on television and even more on radio, I'm retiring from the program.
This is Bill Monroe inviting you to Meet the Press.
I am Marvin Keld.
I'm Roger Mudd.
The president invited the foreign minister, Mr. Gromyko. Congress is back, but from the arguments you're already hearing, you'd never know it had gone.
I'm Chris Wallace.
I'm Gary Gunn.
That's all for today. We'll be back next week. If it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press. You're saying that's not enough. We need structural change in Medicare.
Oh, Tim, look, we need structural changes in Medicare.
There have been two meetings.
Oh, I would doubt it.
Would be 269.
But my larger point is
if it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press.
If it is Sunday.
If it's Sunday. Because if it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press.
1951, former Cubs first baseman and future TV star of Rifleman, Chuck Connors, is the first player to oppose the major league draft. So
Chuck Connors?
So here's the guy, yeah, that was on, ooh, you're right? he was a Cubs first baseman.
Yeah, I knew he played.
Isn't that crazy?
And then became an actor.
And became
I
an
love
actor.
The Rifleman. Now, you're too young for this, but some of the folks in the audience my age would remember another series that he was in the mid-1960s called Branded.
Oh, yeah.
You remember Branded?
I remember the show existed. I knew that. I think they actually might do like a Sunday or Saturday
they
on
may
TV
show it
with
again.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. But The Rifleman.
The Rifleman was the one where he really came to fame.
My friends at MeTV tell me that hour that they air The Rifleman is one of the highest rated hours during their day.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Huh.
That, like out of all the shows that they carry, that's the big one. Yeah, pretty
well,
fun.
You've got a heartwarming premise there.
That's true.
A single father raising the young boy, and he gets the all he wants to do is be a farmer.
Yeah,
and he finds himself in precarious situations, and because of his expertise and prowess with a rifle, he gets out of a jam.
Yep,
saves the town too.
Yep, great show. No, it's a great show.
It is. I've enjoyed that myself.
1963, Bell Telephone introduces the push button telephone. How convenient is that? Also, 1963.
We had one.
Yeah,
my father had one up until last year.
That's all right. I have one that's in my basement in my bar. I actually bought a rotary phone.
Yeah.
I had to have AT&T come out and connect it though because they had to like finagle it and do put together some interesting little wiring.
Oh, because it wouldn't be adaptable for the the lines today.
Yeah, and now I can totally use it. I can dial out. Kids are fascinated by it. Also, 1960.
You have a crank phone, too?
I have no crank phone. It's funny. No crank phone. 1968, the first interracial TV kiss between Kirk and Uhura on Star Trek. 68, also, Beatles release Beatles, the White Album, their only double album. 1980, I know you're really excited about this. It is revealed that Kristen shot J.R.
Ah, yes.
On Dallas. Let's take a listen.
You went to the office that night with J.R.'s gun. It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R. Then the next morning while I was showering, you hid the gun in the closet.
You know, so that was so, you know, people waited all summer. It was like 5 months, I think, and he was on every magazine cover internationally. When he got shot, this was like the one of the biggest things in television.
I was working my first job in radio, and I can remember our old-fashioned teletype machines outside the newsroom. And with all that was going on in the world, that was still in the middle of the Iranian hostage crisis, where we had people in the held hostage in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. With all of that going on and all of the other tension in the world, the night of the show where we were going to find out who shot JR, that was one of the in the some of the hourly summaries that United
that
Press
amazing?
International was putting out.
It was
that
news.
Was leading the top of the summaries.
Amazing. That was news. It was news.
But it was.
It was.
And it had to be one of the highest rating getters.
It was. Of a TV series. Still is, I think, of a TV series. Absolutely. In the 1998, of course, the Lewinsky scandal. First he denied it. Then he accepted it. Let's take a listen.
But I want to say one thing to the American people.
President Bill Clinton, there he is.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again.
Angry.
Husband of Hillary Clinton. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Responsibility
Part two.
For all my actions, both public and private. And that is why I'm speaking to you tonight. As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong. It constituted a critical lapse in judgment and a personal failure on my part, for which I am solely and completely responsible. But I told the grand jury today, and I say to you now, that at no time did I ask anyone to lie, to hide or destroy evidence, or to take any other unlawful action.
When you put a monster who eats cookies, an oversized bird, a garbage-loving grouch, and a green frog together in a room, well, you end up with the finest children's television program in history. Sesame Street has been entertaining millions and millions of preschoolers for 50 years.
Sally, you've never seen a street like Sesame Street.
Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Vo-vo-vo-dee-o.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. The ladybugs came to the ladybugs picnic.
When green is all there is to be, it could make you wonder why.
Why wonder?
Hey, Ernie, do you know that you have a banana in your ear?
What was that, Bert?
This is near. This is
What's the name of that song?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Well, I'll give it to him when he comes back.
Big Bird, Mr. Hooper's not coming back.
Do you, Maria, take Luis to be your husband?
I do.
Round and around and around and around. That's how it feels with wheels on my heels.
I told you all along that there was a Snuffleupagus, my best pal.
Now the season, another reason for eating cookie.
Love.
It's Gordon.
No.
My home. My nest. My
Big Bird, my Big Bird, Big Bird. It's all right. It's all right.
No, it's not.
You're right, Big Bird. It's not all right, but it will be all right.
Oh, I'ma keep my head up high. Keep on reaching high. Never gonna quit. I'll keep getting stronger.
There's nothing else that can compare with my hair.
Did someone order a tall glass of superhero?
What? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Hey, whoa, stop the music.
I need some sneakers, just like your sneakers. If I had sneakers, I could run and play all day.
I feel a rhyme coming on.
You do?
Okay.
When there's a petty need, Bird Whistle is there at full speed.
Do you like food? Me like food. Place your order if you're lucky. We make food in our foodie truck. Yeah!
Where are we going?
Julia has autism. She likes it when people know that.
We can all be friends. It feels a little better when we all play together. We can all be friends.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. So 2 years ago on Veterans Day weekend, I had the pleasure of having radio legend Gary Meyer live in studio with me to talk about his career and to share the tradition of an audio recording of his father, Frank Meyer, and his service in World War II, recalling the 48-hour period of battle in December of 1944. And now podcasting every day at GaryMeyer.com, Radio Hall of Famer. Gary Meyer joins us in studio. What's up, buddy?
Hey, David. Thank you. Well, Monday through Friday at GaryMeyer.com.
Monday through Friday, yep.
Yeah, and I'm really enjoying that.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's
It's been a nice transition.
Well, I'm thrilled that you agreed to join us tonight. And you're no stranger to overnights. You did that yourself.
I did. And I have to say, it was one of the most peaceful times I've spent on the radio because I was in the studio. It was in the John Hancock Building in Chicago, and the 100-story big black monster you see when you drive in and out of the city.
Yeah.
And I would be up there by myself, and it was very peaceful. There was no management and anybody looking over your shoulder. And the listeners that worked all night were your solid listener because that was their schedule, 11
buddies.
To 7.
Oh, yeah.
I'd have a guy call. I work 11 to 7 at the 7-Eleven. I remember that guy. And they were there for you because that was their shift, and it was very routine and rhythm, and the rhythm was there every night where they would call in a lot. So we had a solid relationship.
I hear from Jimmy the Bread Guy at about 4 in the morning every single week. You know, so I've got some buddies
so
out
you
there.
Know that.
I know that, and people ask me all the time, you know, why are you doing, you know, you have a full-time job during the week, you're married, kids, you know, why are you doing this overnight?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to ask you that for so long. So now that we're on the air, tell us why you do this.
It's my time. This is Dave time for me to hang out with the listeners and tell great stories and have great conversations like this one here.
See, I think you're probably better off doing it the way you're doing with the way the business is now because you don't have to rely on it for a total living. And you don't have to put up with all the nonsense that's out there. So you go in and you do it and have fun.
I do my
shit. And you go home and you have your regular job.
Yeah. I was a guest on your show now and then, always tied into the Broadcast Museum somehow or the Radio Hall of Fame. But I think we only did one crossover, and that was when I filled in for Pete McMurray and when he was on at 7 o'clock on Friday nights. And I was probably more nervous than anything, like I am right now. Because
why are you nervous? We're friends.
Because I know, but I'm just telling you, I grew up listening to you and listening to you and Steve and with Ro and as host of your own show for as long as I can remember. I mean, since I was a kid. And those crossovers, which I so much love to do, that was a highlight, listening to The Loop and AM 1000 when it was Brandmeier and you and Steve and Kevin Matthews. And hearing those crossovers was sometimes bigger than the shows themselves.
That was a lot of fun because it got me ready to do the show.
Yeah.
It gave me a little transitional time, and we all had our puppets that we used, and it was just a free form kind of transition from one show to the other.
Yeah.
And a lot of people comment on how they liked that moment.
Yeah.
And some of those crossovers went for a half hour.
I know they did.
Yeah.
I know they did, which is so rare. And that crossover is what paired you and Steve together, because you were doing overnights, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. That's how that happened. I was doing all nights at The Loop in Chicago, or WLUP as it's referred to sometimes. And I loved that shift, as I said. And then the station was sold, and then they brought in Steve, and I was ending at 6. He was starting at 6, and I said something, and then he said, hey, let's work that out. I want to continue along that line. And then somebody in management, after a week, said, hey, I think you two should work together, and that's how that happened.
And that's what happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was looking at some statistics because, you know, average radio listener today listens to about 96 minutes of radio. And that's random, jumping in and out of conversations all day. That is not one continual conversation you're listening to. But back then, and again, I was in high school at the time, but I grew up a little bit at the end of the Larry Lujack WLS kind of thing, but I really was a Loop guy and an AM 1000 guy, and I was a loyal listener. And that radio, much like WGN, is you turn on that radio at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you really never turned it off, and you never stopped listening, no matter what you were doing. You were working, you were driving. I mean, that's what we did. We were like part of you guys. You know?
Yeah. It was a moment where we caught a wave, and Chicago had not had anything like that.
Right.
And we filled something that was needed, apparently, and it worked.
I saw and I told you about this once over dinner, that I saw an interview online on Lee Phillips' Noon Break,
mm-hmm,
with you and Steve. Mm-hmm. And Lee didn't know what to make of you two and was trying to laugh along the way, but I don't think she understood half the things you guys were talking about. And she said, you must be in management's office a lot. I'm sure that was the case in those days.
We did have some, yeah.
Yeah.
Moments where,
yeah,
we were always being pulled in and told not to do this or do that. But that was just part of the shtickle, because,
yeah, right,
after those meetings, we go back on the air and talk about the meeting and how they didn't want us to do this that we were just doing again.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so it just became, we folded, I think, just about everything we could into the show. Yeah. Of what was happening around us.
But they had to know at some point in your career, as your career continued on, that they knew that what they were going to get. I mean, that's why they hired you, right?
That's what we thought. But then we'd have those moments where they hired us, and then they tried to reel us in, and we would think, why would you hire us when you knew what we did? We had been doing it for years.
Yeah.
But again, it was just all part of the circus.
Yeah, I bet. And really, you gave up pharmacy school for nearly 45 years of radio, right?
Yeah, I had to grab onto something. I was one of those people that didn't know what they wanted to do when they got out of high school,
yeah,
and then go into college. And I was working at a pharmacy, and I just thought, well, there's a young guy here who's a pharmacist. He seems to be happy. He's making money. I'll do that. And that sounded good until I started doing the schooling, and it was way over my head.
Yeah.
In fact, if I applied today, I would never get in, because it was a lot looser apparently back then or something, but I would never get in now.
So what appealed to you? Like, how did you even get into that?
Because I was listening to radio, as we all did in our youth, and I heard, as you mentioned him, Larry Lujack. I don't know, some people might not even know who he is anymore, but this was a guy who I really liked because he was very sarcastic, and it was unlike anything else I had heard on the radio before he arrived in Chicago. And he had this feature called the Clunk Letter of the Day, where he would read a listener's letter. In tandem with that, he would also talk about being reincarnated as a butterfly. In fact, now that he's dead, I have to be aware that he might be out there as a butterfly,
sure,
if someone or one of them lands on me. And I saw this dead, I've told this story a lot, maybe some people haven't heard it, but
please.
I saw this dead monarch butterfly on our lawn, and I thought, I'm going to send this to Larry and write a note that I think I killed one of his relatives. Because I was listening and picking up those little idiosyncrasies of what he was into, and I thought, well, that might grab something. So I did that, and a few days later, sure enough, I'm at the drugstore working. I was a cashier. I was working at this drugstore in Oak Forest, and I hear, well, a friend of mine called the drugstore because he heard Larry say, I'm going to read, because I told some friends of mine I'd sent the letter. This friend of mine called the drugstore and said, hey, I just heard Larry say he's going to read a letter from some idiot in Oak Forest, Illinois, who sent him a dead butterfly. Well, I thought, that's me.
It's karma,
so
right?
I had the pharmacist turn off the beautiful music that they would play in the drugstore and put on, I think it was on WLS at that point.
Okay.
And sure enough, he read my letter and just made fun of me. And I thought, this is the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
All right.
My material, Larry Lujack is making fun of me. And that was, as Oprah would say, my aha moment.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, I don't know how to get into that business, but if I can somehow get into that business, that's what I want to do. But I had still the pharmacy school to go through and fall out of and all that. And then I worked construction for 2 years after that because...
Okay, so this was still a little far off.
Oh, yeah.
You, okay.
So the letter was read in 69. I didn't start in radio until 73.
Okay.
And there was that, like I said, that twist and turn of pharmacy school and then working construction to get some money in the bank.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I looked, okay, now how do I get into radio? And I looked in what was now... It's obsolete. The yellow pages.
Yeah.
Do we have phone books anymore? And there were
They still get dropped off. I don't know who pays for them and who's making money off
them.
They
go right into recycling.
Of course
who uses those?
Nobody.
Back then, that's where you look for stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, did they have broadcasting schools in the yellow pages? And sure enough, they had three or four in Chicago. And I picked one and started going. And then I met a guy teaching there who helped me get a job, and it just started from that point on.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then The Loop was probably the big one that you
I started at this station called WFYR.
Yep.
It was all automated and all oldies, and I would just plug the machine in for 4 hours a night. I worked all nights there, too. And that was – or I'd record the news and the weather and plug it into the machine. That was radio. And I thought, great, I got a job in radio after a few months of just starting. I'm not complaining.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But I wanted to be on the radio, and I heard – a station out in the suburbs was hiring, and I went out there and got hired at WYEN.
Okay.
Spent 3 years there and honed my craft.
Okay.
Although, thank God, the internet wasn't around then because there are no records of this. Now all this
You're happy about that. Yeah.
This stuff follows you around forever.
It does.
And I was lucky enough to have that section of my career where it was probably really bad.
Okay.
There's no record of it.
So when you were doing overnights, how long was that shift on The Loop?
On The Loop was 4 hours, 2 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Okay, all right. And did you get to talk much, or was it really
I thought
it's overnight.
Was,
I thought you'd maybe have a little more freedom to have a conversation.
We played the classic rock, your Uriah Heep, your Zeppelin, your Stones.
Yeah.
But there was some time in between, and it was a lot looser because nobody in management was listening from 2 to 6 a.m., so I could maybe stretch the format a little more.
Sure.
And that was fun because I was coming from the suburbs to this big rock station.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a moment. And I was, the all-night shift, happy to get it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when you guys were doing, when you paired up with Steve and stuff and you were doing radio, what did you, there was times that you were working for stations where you had to plug more music into the show and was less talking back and forth. I mean, what did you enjoy most about those days? Was it more about just talking to one another for 3-4 hours, talking to the listeners and engaging and so forth? Or what was
we played music every now and then at our discretion, but I got to be honest, after a while...
It was gone.
Yeah.
You never heard it again, right? Yeah.
Right. And they, every now and then, play more music. It'll help your act out. It'll make you stay fresh and all that.
It's management we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And then finally, we just said, wait a minute, it's a talk show.
Yeah.
We don't need to play music.
Yeah.
It seems silly at this point. And eventually, it all went away, and it was just 100% talk.
Which is really what you've done for 45 years. In so many different great incarnations, too, right?
Yeah, it's been, as the Grateful Dead would say, it's a long, strange trip.
And now podcasting, where, there's some more freedoms to what you're doing.
Oh, this is a whole different animal. And it got started when I was at WGN. They put me on their digital platform
right
for about 6 months before I left. But the fact is, when I got onto the digital platform, there were no rules. It was, this is the Wild West.
Yeah.
I'll never forget the first day I was on the digital platform. I talked for an hour and 45 minutes straight because I was so used to a format.
Right.
Even when I worked with
6 minutes, 7 minutes.
People in different formats, you have to talk for six. Well, you talk for six and then you have to stop and do whatever their business
sure,
is.
Sure, sure.
So I was so used to that for so many years that when I got onto the digital platform and didn't have to do that, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And to this day, now doing my podcast for the last almost 2 years, I can talk for as long as I want. That's especially valuable when I'm interviewing somebody because the rhythm is different and it flows in a much different manner. And I really like that.
Well, you notice we haven't gone to break. See, so overnights, there's a little more freedom.
That's what
as you
say.
Know, too, I can talk for 20 minutes to somebody and not break that flow of that conversation or the concentration or the focus of that conversation.
And I know people listening think, well, why is that a big deal? But
it is.
This conversation put earlier into the day, we would have stopped at least once already
this
or twice.
This would have been three segments already.
Seriously.
During the day.
We've talked that long.
We've talked
See, that's what I mean.
Already. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
And listen, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
That's how they make their money.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But I, at this point, enjoy that freedom.
You can kind of do this everywhere, too, right?
Have done it everywhere.
Yeah.
We've traveled a lot in the last couple of years, and I just set up the weird stuff to me in all this is having seen the equipment from 40 years ago and now, where it's a couple computers and a microphone.
Yeah.
And to see this transition is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So it's time at this point to look at things differently than I did 20 years ago.
Interesting. Interesting thought, man. We are here tonight to continue a tradition that Gary started many years ago on Veterans Day, talking about his father, World War II veteran Frank Meyer, as he shares his special recording about the 48-hour period battle in December 1944. And we're going to do that after we come back with radio legend Gary Meyer next on 720 WGN. All right, Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're hanging out here with Gary Meyer. I got to ask you, Gary, you know, we talked about a lot about your early career, and we're about to talk about your dad a little bit. How supportive were your folks, like, in your career to get into radio? Did they wanted you to be the pharmacist? Did they want you to get into radio?
I think they were supportive no matter what I was doing. I'll never forget the time when I told them I was going to drop out of pharmacy school. I know they were disappointed, but I also got the feeling, hey, if it's not right, it's not right. You've got to find something that you want to do. And they all along said, yeah, if you want to do that. And then when I got into radio, they got a kick out of that. So they really enjoyed the ride as much as I did.
So tell me about your relationship with your dad, because he passed away in the early 90s, right?
Yeah, he was 68.
Okay.
And a lot of it, I think, at this point was due to the fact that he was injured in the war. And then when he had a heart attack, they needed more parts to repair the heart, and they weren't there. So he lasted, after he had the heart attack, 6 months before he died. And 68 seemed very young. And
yeah, really it is very young.
In my head now, I mean, with the life expectancy of what it is. But he lost an eye in the war. I mean, he really got banged up. And it was kind of tough to watch. And it's tough to watch a lot of veterans who go off and then suffer these traumatic injuries and come back. And if we don't support them fully, I don't understand that at all. And you hear these situations where the VA hospitals, there's a lot of red tape. And I'm thinking, my God, of all the stuff that should be priority one, that is it.
My grandfather, his name was Joseph Gendy. He was a World War II vet. He received a Purple Heart for his injuries as well. And I remember sitting with him, and he died back in 86. And I was just a kid. I was like 18 years old. So I really didn't get to dive deeply with him about war days or really anything else as an adult. But I remember sitting with him, watching war movies, you know, or watching at night WTTW and watching not the movies, but actually segments of the war itself or whatever, but he never really talked about it. There was only a few times he opened up about his experience. Not a lot of veterans do. Did your dad talk a lot about it?
No, that tape that you're going to play is really all of what he kept in his head and shared with us as far as that goes.
It's
14 minutes. But I think, and I've thought about this many times over the years, those guys come back and they just went to work, they got married, they had families, and that was in the past. They were not allowed to talk, not allowed, but they didn't have anybody to talk to about it because we didn't know PTSD then.
No. We did that.
And I think a lot of these guys had it and just thought, this seems like a weak thing to do. If I start complaining or I have any issue with this, people are going to think I'm a sissy or whatever the tone was back then.
Yeah.
Which was really sad because I know a lot of guys from that era, and my father included. I'll give you a couple examples. The day he had his heart attack, my mother was next to him in the hospital. They were wheeling him into the ICU, and he turned to her and said, "Do you have the hand grenades?" He thought he was back in the war, back on a stretcher. Another day, my brother slammed a door. He was in bed. He jumped up, and he thought he was in battle again. We had an engineer when we worked at WLS who was in the Vietnam War, and a sound triggered something, and he went off. And the Vietnam vets, I think, were just starting to form the fact that there was something here that they had to explore, the medical personnel.
Sure.
The PTSD syndrome that they finally identified. But a lot of these guys had to suffer in silence or they didn't know who to talk to. And it's got to be the stuff they saw in battle. And you'll hear this in the tape.
And we'll hear that historic tape of Gary's father next on 720 WGN. All right. My conversation with Gary Meyer on this Veterans Day weekend continues.
My dad sat down at the kitchen table. I'll never forget the day I walked in right after he had recorded this.
Yeah, so how did that all happen? Yeah.
So I went over to visit, and he was home by himself. And I walked in, and he was sitting at the kitchen table, and he had that little Panasonic tape recorder that was omnipresent in everybody's home. And he said, "Hey, I just recorded something. I want you to hear it. Maybe you can play it
on
your show."
So he did it on his own. So he did it on his own first.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. And right. I think what happened, I believe it was winter, was 1982. And I'm sure, and you'll hear it in the tape too, he was looking out the back window and there was a farmhouse, and that reminded him of what was going on in this battle that he's talking about here. And I think he just had to get it out. Think about what these guys saw, and after a while, you have to say something.
But 40 years later, we're talking about, seriously.
Okay, get this. About 7-8 years before that, he, with some old Army buddies, went over to those theaters of war, the locations.
Wow, so he went back.
To see, yeah. Okay. So get this. So they go to this house where these people sheltered them from the Nazis because they were outnumbered and they had to go somewhere, otherwise they would have all been killed. So these people put them down in their cellar until the Nazis left. They went back on that trip in the early 80s, late 70s, knocked on the door. The same people were living there. When they knocked on the door that saved their lives. Yeah, that kind of stuff. So I think as the years went on, these guys wanted to go back. They wanted to have some kind of closure with what they went through. And I wouldn't blame them.
Yeah.
But they were the only guys that understood what they went through. So they had to keep each other in that frame of, I can talk to you. You know what we went through.
But again, 40 years later,
I
decided to grab a mic and a tape recorder and throw it all down.
And thank God he did. And the first time we played it, the reaction from the listener.
Oh, I remember it. Oh, I remember.
Yeah, people that had family, friends, whatever, that went through whatever theater of war, talking about how emotional they were. They were driving in their car and listening to this tape and just sobbing. Because it's so moving in that you can feel like you're in this battle. And the way he tells this story. And I'm so glad I have this and that I can share it with a lot of people.
Yeah. What'd your dad do for a living after the war and stuff?
He had a series of dry cleaners on the south side of Chicago. I worked at the dry cleaners when I was, they didn't have these child labor laws back then. Okay. I believe I was 9 or 10 working in the back of this dry cleaners running all this heavy machinery.
That's where you got your work ethic from.
One of my favorite memories as a kid, he had the radio on and Paul Harvey would come on every day. And I would hear Paul Harvey. And then many years later, I got to watch Paul Harvey do a newscast. And for me, because of that connection of my childhood and with my father, I thought I was watching the Beatles record a song.
That's
in
so
my
cool.
head, because then I went into radio.
Cool.
So that was my memory of working at the dry cleaners. And then he went into life insurance for a number of years and was very successful at that. So those were his two careers, dry cleaners and life insurance.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So this tape, again, recorded 1982 at the kitchen table in his home. The World War II story of Frank Meyer about the 48-hour period of battle in December 1944.
As I look out my bedroom window every December with the little farmhouse behind us, my thoughts are reflected in December of 1944. Our division had just received word that the Germans had broken through our lines and had advanced 50 miles into Belgium. The whole mood at the time in our camp was one of concern and apprehension, for we all thought that the war would soon be over, since we were now fighting on German soil. I knew that being an infantryman in General Patton's Third Army meant a lot of action. Headquarters had sent word down to all our companies to be ready to move out as soon as possible. The next morning, we piled into our trucks with our gear and was well on our way to the front lines. It was a very slow-moving process, for the trucks were bumper to bumper, and the weather was turning cold with blowing snow. We trudged along all that day, moving at a snail's pace, going along at about 10 to 15 miles an hour. And in our haste, we even had to bring the German prisoners along with us, because we didn't have time to dispose of them through the proper channels. One of the GIs I remembered even yelled out, "What are we doing? Bringing reinforcements for the Germans?" That day, the column moved slowly due to the fact that we took all the secondary roads while the armored took to the main highways. That evening, we stayed in a hayloft in the barn, and the temperature now had fallen into the teens. We covered up ourselves as best as we could with all the hay around us, and it was a very comfortable feeling after riding all day with the snow and the wind blowing at your face. It wasn't long, however, when the sergeant called my name to pull guard duty. Boy, I could have shot that sergeant for waking me up from that nice warm spot in the hayloft. It must have been around 2 or 3 in the morning. Time didn't matter much because you realized that you weren't punching a clock to go home. I pulled my first guard duty with an little Italian from Brooklyn. He was only about 5'2" and weighed about 110 pounds dripping wet. We went to our positions together, which was a machine gun emplacement. He was a very quiet individual, although I did try to make conversation. I nicknamed him the Little Paisan, and to this day I still do not remember his name. During the course of our guard duty, he pulled out a little gas burner from underneath his coat and proceeded to cover himself over with his raincoat. And before long, he had a steady blue flame going. We had to be careful not to expose any of this light in the event that the Germans were in the surrounding area. He warmed up our rations while I kept watch for both of us. That was the first warm food we had had for 3 days. I said to myself, "Boy, I'm going to keep close to that little guy for the cold days ahead." The next morning, our outfit started out on foot toward the front. We were told to keep moving until we engaged the enemy, for at this point we did not know where the Germans had advanced to. We had walked about 20 miles that day and took refuge that evening out in the open, digging our foxholes and keeping watch all that night. The next morning we started out once again. I was trying to stay as close to my little Italian friend, because warm K rations now were very appealing to me. It wasn't long, however, that I heard rifle fire ahead, and our lieutenant yelled, "Hit the side of the road." I jumped immediately to a ditch covered with snow and laid there frightened with the realization that this would be my first major engagement with the enemy. We were now being shelled and pinned down by German tanks firing from the reverse side of the slope, which was from a little town of Haastrecht, Belgium. Our artillery started its barrage, but some of the shells were falling short into our own lines. This soon was corrected, and we inched our way closer so that our firepower from our company and the other flanking us would become very effective. Needless to say, the battle raged on all that day and late into the afternoon. The medics were hurrying about picking up the wounded. By nightfall, the few remaining Germans had surrendered, and the tanks had rambled off to the next town, which was Eschdorf. I was amazed at how young some of the Germans were, 16, 17 years of age. They were all dressed in white fur-lined garments, which of course was hard to see when they were blended in with a snowy background. We still had our brown khakis and made a good target laying out there in the snow. Our outfit was quickly assembled, and we were told that night that we would make an attack at about 1 a.m. Our objective was the town of Eschdorf. After a warm meal and a few hours' rest, we again set out to meet the enemy. We had not gone very far when the Germans opened fire and pinned us down. Off in a distance, I heard some of our tanks coming up in position. Before they even stopped, the German Tiger tanks had opened fire and made direct hits on two of our tanks. I heard the men screaming, and then there was total silence. I laid there motionless on the frozen snow, looking up at the stars of heaven. It was a clear night, and all the stars twinkled. At this moment, I realized it was Christmas Eve. Christ was born today, 1944 years ago. Peace on earth, goodwill toward all men. This peace suddenly came all over me, and I wish to quote from the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. At this time, Lieutenant Gisco called back to his men, and he said, "Let's go." We proceeded to run in a staggered formation over the Nola Hill. Now, the small arms fire from the village of Eschdorf became very intense as our whole battalion of infantry moved forward. I continued to follow the lieutenant, getting up and falling down at his command. Now the Germans started to open up with their mortar, artillery, and machine guns. We had finally reached the outskirts of Eschdorf behind a farmhouse, and as we were about to group with our platoon leader, we heard a tank approaching in the near distance. We all scattered in the farmyard and lay quietly as the tank went slowly by us toward the farmhouse and then toward Eschdorf. About eight of us ran toward the house, and the rest of the men headed for the barn. Fortunately, there were no Germans here. We went into the cellar of the house and kept close watch all at the entrance. It wasn't long when we heard tanks coming our way again, and thinking that our armored forces finally broke through the stiff resistance. But to our dismay, it was the German armor that was in command. We all realized that our battalion was halted in reaching its objectives, and a handful of men that were in the outskirts of this small village were trapped. I now began to pray to the Blessed Virgin to save us. As I prayed ceaselessly, I closed my eyes momentarily and saw the Blessed Virgin dressed in black, throwing a black veil over us. We were watching the German tanks moving about the farmyard, hoping and praying that we would not be discovered. Daylight was soon upon us on Christmas Day. All that morning, everything was quiet, with the tanks in the same position, waiting to spit out the death and destruction. Soon, I began to hear our artillery The shells were slamming all around us. Then our planes began to strafe the whole area. This continued on for hours. Then we heard voices upstairs, and they were yelling in German. We hurriedly fixed our bayonets and were ready for what was to come. I continued to pray the Hail Marys as we anxiously awaited. We all waited breathlessly as seconds seemed like hours. Soon the voices were gone, and I thanked the Blessed Virgin. The shelling continued on through the night. We all knew that our forces were getting ready for another attack on Eschdorf. That attack came in the early morning hours. We could not leave our cellar, for we were caught in a crossfire. The top part of the farmhouse had now collapsed from all the shelling. Our planes began to strafe again and again. And after a long silence, we looked out in the farmyard and saw our GIs walking toward us. We all were overjoyed. The Germans had retreated. I immediately started running toward Hostert. And suddenly my eyes were gazing upon all my fallen comrades. My heart was saddened as I continued to walk slowly back to town. And then I spotted my little Italian friend, clutching his rifle in one hand and his small gas burner in the other hand. He was killed Christmas Eve. Christ was born Christmas Eve. As I prayed in a small church on a hill, my thoughts were with all my fallen brothers, for God had called them to their eternal reward. I wish to quote from John chapter 15, verse 13. And here is how to measure it. The greatest love is shown when a person lays down his life for his friends. As I left the little church, the command was given to move out, for once again, we were getting ready to meet our foe. I asked the Lord to calm my fears and grant me a happy death should it come. The season of Advent will soon be upon us. It is going to be December 1982. Christ will be born Christmas Eve. Men will die Christmas Eve. Nothing has changed. My fellow Christians, Christ is calling on us to bring his love to the world so we may rise above the animal, to the human, and then to the divine. This, my brothers and sisters, is my Christmas experience that our Lord wanted me to share with you. Please pray for all my fallen comrades and the fallen enemy, for we all are children of God. And may we continue to pray for peace throughout the world.
Pretty impactful when you hear a story like that directly from one of the greatest generation.
I know. And again, we don't have a lot of records on what they went through, and these guys are dying by the thousands every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
My father would have been, that was 26 years ago, he would have been 94 at this point.
Yeah.
And if you made it to that, but a lot of these guys don't, and they're dwindling. So some people have realized this and have gone out and started to get them on videotape or audio tape to preserve some of what they went through.
Did he talk about it anymore after that, or was that tape kind of the
definitive
story?
That was it. I think he got it out in those 14 minutes, and I don't remember a lot of other conversation after that about it. And it's unfortunate. But again, it's got to be so painful to relive some of that.
That's why when we talk about
these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I'm thinking, my God, when do we learn the carnage? And then you come back, and then we don't treat them the way they should be treated. Yeah. That's just sinful.
Yeah, and we have to remember all of those who fought and served our country on this Veterans Day, and I'm so grateful that you shared that with us again.
No, hey, I'm glad you asked me to do this.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's 720 WGN.